Here is Jerusalem. It's this little tiny dot right there. And camped around him is the army of Assyria, at least some of them. The main army of Assyria is down here at Lachish. Now, Lachish is only, let's measure it here, Lachish is only about 30 miles away. Now, that's as the crow flies, so it's a little farther when you have to weave in and out of those Judean hillsides, but 30 miles is about a 2 days' march. So imagine the mass of your enemy's army is only 2 days away, and standing in front of your gate is a contingent of that army, large enough itself to level your city. And the commander of that army marches up to your front gate, knocks on the door, says, "I got a message for you. My master, the king of Assyria, is going to come in here. He's going to destroy this city, and he's going to take all of you captive and scatter you throughout the Assyrian Empire. Now, if you surrender, we'll be nice to you. We'll let you live in your own nice little house until we move you away. If you don't surrender, it's going to get really bad. We're going to starve you out. You're going to be condemned to," and he says, "eat your own dung and drink your own urine," because that's what happens in a siege. Now, probably we have never been faced with that kind of harsh existence. I love to hear the stories about some of the guys that went through World War II, and the things that they were able to accomplish just amaze me, because I recognize my generation's kind of wimpy. You know, we do get a little disturbed when there's not enough caramel or frozen pizza in the house. And so these are guys that faced those horrible situations and just said, "It's got to get done. We have to find a way to make it happen." And they did. Or going back a little before that in the generation before them and enduring the Great Depression. And hear the stories coming out of that. Just that can-do attitude of saying, well, this is life. Yes, it's hard. It's not fun. It's uncomfortable. But it's what we've got, and we've got to deal with it. And boy, you hear stories today of people attacking McDonald's workers because the food didn't come out. And I heard a story on the news just yesterday. A woman pulled out a taser and zapped the McDonald's worker because the food didn't come out quick enough. So, that's a complaint department, right? Yeah. I don't think Ethan's had to deal with that just yet, but he is at work today. But there's a whole difference in the level of difficulty that people are able to bear. I recognize my generation has grown up in the most prosperous world that's ever existed on this planet. And that's had an effect on us. So we are a bit wimpy. We don't like to endure difficulties. If things don't go our way, we complain very quickly and we give up and we pout. I know that. It's a sorry thing to see a full-grown man pout, isn't it? So just ask the kids. They can tell you when things don't go well. But here's Hezekiah, and he's faced with this situation. Multiply ours by infinity, and you'll get about the difficulty of this. So he has now lost every major fortified city in Judea to the Assyrians. They've conquered it. And so right about here, if you go from Jericho over just south of Geba, and then over to Ekron, everything north of that is the country of Samaria, the northern country. It's already been deported. It's gone. The people are not there anymore. And just the poorest of the people left in these areas. So it's been decimated already by the Assyrians. And now all of the major fortified cities around Jerusalem have been taken. There wasn't a whole lot down here in this area. It's very desert-like, hilly, not much growing there. But if you form an arc from the Dead Sea up here to Jerusalem and then down this side of the mountains, you've got some major cities, some very good land there. And so there were fortified cities all along here to protect the approaches of the mountains up to Jerusalem. Jerusalem's the last line of defense, and they've been backed up against it. Jerusalem is it. That's all that's left. Hezekiah has made as many preparations as he can. If you read the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 36 and 37, you'll find out that he has taken the pains to collect a whole bunch of armor and weapons in Jerusalem. He even dug a tunnel to bring water into Jerusalem. How many of you have heard about Hezekiah's tunnel? Eldon, pretty impressive thing, isn't it? Still there. Yep. Yep. 2,600 years later, this thing is, no, 27, almost 2,800 years later, this tunnel is still there. And what the tunnel was designed to do was to bring water into the city, under the walls and into the city, so that if there was a siege, the city still had access to fresh water. One of the most important things in enduring a siege is having enough rain or having enough water, and of course it doesn't rain much there. So Hezekiah has undertaken these major projects to try to protect Jerusalem, but he also had fortified cities all throughout Judah, and they've all fallen. I mean, this is a desperate situation because there's no earthly course of action left. Hezekiah is looking around at his fortifications in Jerusalem. He looks at the size of the Assyrian army, and he recognizes there's no way we can defend the city if they decide to attack. However, he's going to latch on to one thing that happened. How did the messenger present his case? What kinds of things did he say? We're going to come in and attack you. We're going to destroy your city. Was that how he left it? How did he paint the picture, Eldon? Right.
And he just and he insulted God.
And there's where we get to it, right? He didn't just insult Hezekiah, he insulted God. Okay, we ran into another guy that insulted God a little ways back. He was about 9.5 feet tall, big burly fella, carried a huge spear shield. His name was Goliath. I defy the armies of Israel this day. And David came out and said, "You have defied the living God." David didn't paint this in any other picture than that you're standing yourself off, you're squaring yourself off against God. Not against Saul, not against the armies of Israel. You've insulted God. How's that going to go for you?
Well,
look at how Goliath ended up. How did Goliath end up?
Yeah.
Lost his head over it, huh? He died. Within minutes after making these statements, Goliath is dead. And God displayed to all of Israel, nobody's more powerful than I am. So, here's this new challenger. And it's not just one guy, though. It's hundreds of thousands of soldiers. And at the head of them is the king of Assyria, and he's sending his message and saying, nobody can save you out of my hand. Nobody. My army's bigger than anything the world's ever amassed before. We've conquered every other nation that we have aimed at. We've destroyed every god that we've come across, including Jehovah. Because we already conquered Samaria, right? So who did Samaria, this northern kingdom? They claimed to worship Jehovah, and they're gone. So what does that tell you about their god? Well, you might think it means he's not very strong. But we're going to see the reply. So we left you hanging a little bit there. Chapter 19, verse 1, as soon as King Hezekiah heard it, this is all the taunting that the Rabshakeh gave out. As soon as King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of the Lord. Now, what's the point of tearing the clothes?
It's Jewish ways of mourning.
Yes. Okay, the Jewish people are extremely expressive people. I don't want to say they're emotional, but they're expressive. You know, we tend to come from good old German stock. We bury our emotions down in there. We don't let anybody know how we're feeling because we think that that's, I don't know, we think that's extreme. You know, if anybody cracks a smile, that's, oh, you're just being giddy, right? But the Jewish people are extremely expressive, and they're a lot of fun to be around, to be honest with you. But they're very, very expressive. And so that grabbing the garment and just tearing it a little bit and falling on the ground and wailing out loud, throwing dust in the air sometimes, they have these expressions that communicate extreme grief, extreme stress. And so he went into the house of the Lord, and he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the secretary, and the senior priests, covered with sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amoz. Yes, that is the prophet Isaiah that you have in your Bible, who wrote an entire book, 66 chapters long. Same guy. So he is alive and well right now. He's in Jerusalem. He's been prophesying to the nation. And guess what one of the messages Isaiah has been sending to the nation has been? Don't submit to Assyria. And don't go where for help?
Egypt.
Don't go to Egypt for help. They'll fail you. Who are you supposed to trust? God. Only God. And Hezekiah is probably looking at the situation saying, really? I've been trusting God and this is where it's got me? Have you ever trusted God? He said, you know what? I've committed my way. I'm going to do what God says. And it got worse. Hezekiah committed himself to obey God way back at the beginning of his rule. He tried to bring Judah back to covenant faithfulness. So they celebrated the Passover. They cleaned all the idols out of Jerusalem and Judea. They even invited the northern people down to celebrate the feast of the Passover. And now here he is facing this massive army and possibly his own extinction along with that of his people. You ever try to do what God wants and it gets worse? Sometimes. Did God ever promise us that if we do it His way, it'd be easy? Never. Don't you wish He would have? I mean, we take some of the statements that we read this morning when in Deuteronomy 6, when Moses is telling the people, you know, keep the commandments of the Lord, that it may go well with you. And under the old covenant, there was this idea, if Israel does what is right, it will generally go well. But God also reserved for himself the right to say, I'm going to put you through tough times once in a while just to test you and see how dedicated to this you are. Because guess when we really prove whether we're committed to doing God's way? Not when it's easy. When it's hard. You know, when life seems like it's falling apart all around you, and when life seems like when I make a godly decision, it makes it harder. You know how many people walk away from godly decisions at that point? It's a lot of them, because they say, you know what, forget it, I did it God's way, I tried that and it got worse, so I'm going my way, because I know how to make it easier. And at some point, here's the trouble with people that are under a lot of stress. You know how you start making decisions when you're under a lot of stress? The next decision is just trying to relieve a little stress. That's all I care about. And so if I've got 20 things going on around me that are stressing the daylights out of me, whatever it is, my next decision starts becoming just about relieving stress, not about doing what's right. Because I'm so pressured by the circumstances of my life that I don't care anymore about what's right and wrong. I just start caring about what's going to make it easier for me. And people start making decisions on that basis instead of on what has God said. But God never gave us a promise that said that life will be easy, and if you obey me, everything will just go hunky-dory. He does tell us that, yes, in general, things are better, and can you testify to say that life has been better because you've obeyed God? I hope you can. All right? When you do things God's way, generally speaking, it turns out better, has better consequences. When you do things sin's way, it always has death as its consequence. Always. It might hold it off for a while. It's kind of like taking that dandelion, that, you know, that white fluffy one, and walking in the middle of your garden. And wasn't that fun? What happens to those millions of little seeds? They land in your garden, and what happens? Now I've got thousands of dandelions with bazillions of seeds. That's what happens when we make sinful decisions. Sin begets sin, and it multiplies, and it takes over your life quickly. Righteousness is like weeding the garden. It's work all the time. And if you ever let that one weed go to seed, you can undo a lot of work. Eldon. Okay.
Take your vacuum sweeper out your garden and suck all the
seeds. That's a good idea. That sounds like a great service you could have to be able to rent out a rototiller or rent Eldon's garden vacuum. Yeah, well, if you have a big enough vacuum, you can get them along with it. Rabbits you got to keep out too. Our stupid rabbit keeps getting out of its cage and getting into my tomatoes. So I still... That's not a problem? No? Oh. You're the one letting them out, right? Yeah. Well, we're looking around like the cage is all shut. I don't understand how this rabbit's getting out. And then I... Oh, no pizza sauce. Oh, now you've got him. He says, we'll buy it from the store, right? Anyway, so he's covered in sackcloth. And he sends to Isaiah. And they said to him, this is the servants of Hezekiah are saying to Isaiah, thus says Hezekiah, this is a day of distress. You think? Of rebuke. Of disgrace. Children have come to the point of birth and there's no strength to bring them forth. What is that statement all about? No one feels like life is worth living. Okay. Some of our ladies might be able to testify in childbirth. They get to that point, you feel like, I just can't push one more time. And then the doctor's got to say something like, come on, one more. It's almost over. Right? It's exhausting, that childbirth process. But what happens if you actually get to the point where you can't push one more time? And the baby can't come out? What happens to the baby? What happens to mom? Something pretty serious, right? And especially back then, think 7th century BC medical technology. You've got the midwives there, and if mom can't push the baby out, what happens? They die. Eldon?
That happened with my last child.
Did it?
And Carolyn couldn't push no more.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor and the nurse were pushing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And they might be able to. Depends on how far along the birth has gone, right? But here's the situation, is that we're at a life and death point here. And there is no human option left. There's no strength to push. Hezekiah is telling the Lord, I got nothing. I have nothing. I don't know what to do. And no strength to bring them forth. So it may be, here's the last thing that he's got. It may be that the Lord your God heard all the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Syria, has sent to mock the living God, and will rebuke the words that the Lord your God has heard. Is he questioning God's ability to hear what's going on? Because he says it may be that the Lord God has heard. Does he mean that God possibly didn't hear that? This is actually good, because what I'm seeing is everybody's burying their head in their text and looking at what it says and trying to figure that out. That's fantastic. What does it say? Is Hezekiah questioning God's knowledge of the events?
The perhaps,
which attaches to which part? God hearing?
Yeah, when he says, perhaps your God
will hear. Okay. But is he saying maybe God didn't hear it?
That's what he's inferring.
He's inferring, okay. Actually, the perhaps attaches to the next part, right? So perhaps God heard and will do something about it. I don't think Hezekiah is calling into question that God knows what's going on. You ever feel like God must not know what's going on in your life? Maybe you've been there at some point. You said, things are getting so bad here, that everything's pressing on me so hard. It's that, God, do you not see what's happening here? And in our minds, we don't really think that God doesn't know what's happening, but what are we questioning? Is he going to do anything about it? Is he going to intervene and help us? Is he going to save us out of this situation? And that's what Hezekiah is expressing here. Not that God doesn't know what's happening, but that, is God going to act? Okay. So it may be that the Lord your God heard all the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to mock the living God, and will rebuke the words that the Lord your God has heard. So Hezekiah also very, very clearly makes this a contest between who?
God and Assyria.
God and Assyria. You notice how he takes himself out of the situation there? That it cracks me up because it reminds me of the... there's this movie we watch with the kids. It's called Penguins. And at one point, these three penguins who act like they are this elite military squad infiltrate all kinds of things, but the three of them are standing in a row and they look up and there's this giant laser beam pointing at him. And the leader looks up at it and his eyes kind of cross and he steps out of the way. So now it's pointing at his next guy. And the next guy looks down like, uh-oh. And I can picture Hezekiah doing this here because he's really removing himself from the situation and painting this as a battle not between himself and the Assyrians, but as between the Assyrians and God. Because he knows what the Assyrians just claimed here. So you know what? No God can stand in front of us. And so Hezekiah is standing in front of God and he's looking back at the Assyrians and he says, you know, I'm just going to step out of the way here and I'm going to let you take care of this. Maybe you've heard and you're going to do something. Therefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. Why do you think he calls them a remnant? What's a remnant?
A small group,
a small portion, right? So remember, all the northern kingdom has been taken away into captivity, and everything around Jerusalem has been conquered. All of the fortified cities have been destroyed. Jerusalem's it. It's all that's left. So he says, you know, I've got a few thousands of people here, but that's about it. Maybe God will intervene and save the remnant. So verse 5, when the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, Isaiah said to them, say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard with which the servants of the king of Assyria have reviled me. Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will make him fall by the sword in his own land. What a marvelous thing when God speaks. When God adds his voice to any situation, it solves it, doesn't it? You ever see the shirts, God says it, God said it, I believe it, that settles it? I would like those if you remove the middle one. God said it, that settles it. Whether I believe it or not, God's declaration is absolute. And so when he speaks to the situation, yeah, sure, I have a responsibility to believe it, but he's going to do it whether I believe it or not. And so God speaks into this situation, and that's really, folks, that's what we're looking for when we're facing difficult circumstances, when we're facing those hopeless situations, when we're facing those times when it looks like there is nothing that can be done. We're waiting for God to say something. And there might be times that that's when you bury yourself in the Word and you're reading, and that's when a verse kind of opens up to you in a way that you never really saw before. Or perhaps somebody has a word of encouragement for you and say, you know, I was just thinking about this and praying for you in your situation the other day, and this verse came to mind. God speaks. He does it through his word. We don't have the prophets today. Hebrews chapter 1 tells us God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spoke through the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us where? Through his Son. Jesus Christ is the end of the prophets. We don't need the prophets anymore because we have the fullness. We have Christ. We have his word. Yeah. Antivirus. All right. So maybe you're facing a tough situation right now. Hezekiah's got a great example for us, and that is keep praying. Keep seeking the Lord's face in it. And don't get off your knees until God answers. And that's simple, but it's not easy. Because that requires us to, number one, not give up hope. Number two, to not quit. Number three, not choose our own way. It requires us to keep doing what we know God has already said, to keep doing it until he gives us further instruction. And it can be the hardest thing in the world to wait on the Lord. Well, Isaiah didn't let Hezekiah wait very long. God spoke to this situation pretty quickly and told Hezekiah what's going to go on. Sometimes in our lives, it'll feel like God's just waiting and waiting and waiting, and he's not doing anything. But don't quit. Don't give up. He will answer, and he will do something. Any questions or comments? I must have been verbose tonight. I didn't get through near what I wanted to get through.